You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hi, everyone. We're back with another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Abby Eblin from Nashville Fertility Center. And today I am joined by my charming and charismatic co-host, Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
Hello.
And Dr. Carrie Bedient from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas.
Hi.
Hey, well, Carrie, how are you doing? I've been so excited.
I think she's a little jet lagged today.
About your trip. You have been to Germany, right?
Yep, Germany and Belgium.
And tell us what you did and what was fun and all the good stuff that you found.
So my office goes, because we both speak at conferences and see patients while we're over there. And in doing this, so we went to three cities over the course of a week. So we were in Cologne first in Germany, and we stayed right across the street from this gorgeous Twin Spire Cathedral.
That's the famous landmark in Cologne, right? Yeah.
Just beautiful. Like it's very surreal coming from Las Vegas, where nothing is more than 50 years old, go to a city where they started construction on this cathedral in 1248 and they didn't finish it until 1880 because they took, a short break of about 300 years in the middle of there. To go to one of those cities where everything just has so much history it's so much fun.
It's amazing.
So we went to all these cities and we were in each one for 48 hours or less because we were moving.
Quick trip. And did you speak somewhere in Cologne as well?
I didn't speak in Cologne. I only spoke in Berlin and Brussels.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. That's pretty impressive.
And so Berlin, there was a Men Having Babies conference that we spoke at. And so that was fun because all those guys are at the very beginning of their journey and they have this lost look. So to see the course of the day go through where they're like, okay, I got this. I kind of have the path down and, give a brief talk there, plus talk to a bunch of people, which is fun. And then talk to some other patients outside of the conference. That was really good. Berlin is a very different city from all the other European cities that I've been to. It's got a very post-industrial feel. It feels like a much heavier, weightier city than many of the other ones, just in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we went to Brussels in Belgium. And that city is just so charming and so sweet. And so you turn a corner and, oh, look, there's another cathedral. It's so cute. And they have a chocolate store on every other corner. Which
I was just going to say, Carrie, did you bring us back any chocolate?
None of it made it back.
Okay.
Carrie does have a little sweet tooth.
If by little, you mean the size of my head. I didn't touch the chocolate that I bought for my kids or my mom.
That's good.
Because even I know who my bosses are. But it was a lovely trip. Like, it's fun to talk to patients. I'm very lucky because I had both a German-speaking and a French-speaking coordinator with me.
Oh, wow.
So it made the translation easy. And Germany is easy to get around as an English speaker because everybody speaks beautiful English.
They do, yeah.
So
my name is German and everybody in Germany pronounced it completely correctly. I mean, there's only a couple ways you can pronounce it, but everybody said, oh, hello, Miss Eblin. How are you? And I'm like, wow.
Say, how do people mess up your last name?
I guess they go like Eblin. Eblin.
Yeah.
Eblin.
Yeah.
Huh.
But yeah, you're amazing. It is amazing. You hear them speak in German fluently and then you say something to them and they speak fluent English as if they barely even have an accent, it seems like. Pretty amazing.
Like they just switch the languages like that. It's so impressive to watch.
Well, that sounds very much fun. That's awesome.
Good stuff.
And I am kind of jet lagged and I took a 3-hour nap today and am still a little fuzzy. So see how that goes.
Well, welcome back to the United States, Carrie. We're glad you made it back safely. Yeah. So we are going to have a question episode today, and we pulled some questions about fertility testing, right? When I say we, Susan pulled some questions about fertility testing that we're going to go through today.
All
so what you got, Susan?
Okay, so our first one is, hi, thanks so much for all you do. I look forward to listening to your podcast weekly. My question is about AMH. How variable does it get? Or are labs reading them differently? I'm almost 39. My AMH in December was 0.5 from my OB's lab. Saw my first fertility specialist in January with a 1.63 result, and another fertility test specialist test in February with a result of 0.867. How am I to know which is correct or most accurate? Is it common to see these types of variances? Thank you.
So that is a fabulous question that I feel like I've been encountering that a lot recently, because the dogma when AMH first came out was that AMH is constant. It doesn't change to the same degree that like an FSH and estradiol will. And you have it, and then it just slowly declines throughout the course of your life. And so that was the teaching, where your AMH is your AMH, and there is nothing you can do to change it. Well, in the years since then, that has slowly evolved, because we're starting to figure out things that can maybe give a suppression result, things that can show variance. So there are multiple assays out there for AMH. And so depending on which one, that can result in some variation. And then similarly, there is some variation just based on what else is going on. So for example, if someone's been on birth control pills forever and ever, amen, might be a little bit lower. But there is variation. So I have patients who describe very much what you're discussing, where I did it this month and it was this, and the next month it was a little higher and then a little lower and all over the place. And so the way that I tend to look at AMH is, what is going to shape your treatment plan? Because very, very much like FSH, it's not a single number that makes you breathe a sigh of relief or makes you worried. It is the general range of numbers. And so if you're in general coming in below about 1.5, then you know, all right, I'm going to move a little faster.
Time is important.
And that's important. And if you have a number that's considerably higher, let's say 5 or higher, then that puts you in another category. So it's less the exact number. And I know as fertility patients and fertility docs, we are all OCD or CDO, as I like to think of it. We're OCD about everything, all of the numbers included, but it's more the general, what does this tell you and how to react to this range of numbers than the specific number?
Yeah, I tell patients it's kind of almost like your blood pressure. Although I will say that's a little bit more variability than what I typically see in patients. But you know, if we check your blood pressure today, tomorrow, and the next day, we're not going to get the exact same number, but it's going to fluctuate up and down kind of around a baseline. And so I tend to treat patients, like Carrie said, or tend to think of them about how is it going to shape your treatment. And so generally, if somebody has a value at some point that's 0.5 and it's a person that's not on birth control pills, I tend to treat you as if that's your number and try and be pretty aggressive, because I worry if that's your lower number, then I worry that, you know, you may not respond as well as maybe somebody with a 1.63 if that was really closer to your number. But, you know, it's kind of one of those things where, you know, I tell patients, there's no number at which I can tell you you can absolutely get pregnant. There's no number at which I can tell you absolutely cannot get pregnant. It's just kind of it gives us a feel for where to start our treatment, basically.
Mm-hmm. So when I think about ovarian reserve testing, one thing that I often tell patients is no ovarian reserve testing is perfect. And so that's why we actually do a few different things. In my practice, I typically do FSH and estradiol, AMH and an antral follicle count. And so I kind of group them into quality and quantity. I think of FSH and estradiol more in the quality era. And then I think of AMH and antral follicle count in the quantity area. So when we're looking at that, if you have a lowish AMH and you have an antral follicle count of 6 or 7, I'm like, this matches up. Because really what I'm watching for is something that's discordant. Okay. So do you have an antral follicle count of 5, but your AMH is 10. That doesn't make sense. Like those things don't match. And so if everything comes together and it fits together, that's what kind of feeds into our algorithms that go in our brain to help us figure out, you know, how aggressive or not aggressive do we need to be.
I would totally agree with that. All right. What else you got?
All right. Hi, I am 33, trying to conceive for 1.5 years. I have attempted an HSG where the radiologist found that my cervix was stenotic and they were unable to put the catheter through. I had a LEAP surgery in 2018, which resulted in painful cramps, but I continued to bleed monthly. Recently, they were able to perform a saline sonogram, but had to use dilators to finally get the IUI catheter through. The results were normal, along with my blood tests and sonogram. My AMH is 6.8 and my partner's semen is normal. The next steps are IUI with letrozole. I'm wondering if this could be impacting my fertility, even though the doctors say since I bleed monthly and the catheter was eventually able to get through, sperm can get in.
So I would tend to agree. I mean, if sperm can get in little itty bitty tiny places. Now, if you were not doing IUI, you know, and if you've had a LEAP procedure, we worry a little bit that the cervical mucus may be a little bit too thick and it may make it difficult for the sperm to kind of swim through there. Because part of what happens mid-cycle when you ovulate, your estrogen level increases. That tends to thin your cervical mucus out. If you've had a LEAP procedure, those mucus glands don't work so well and your mucus is really thick. I think based on your AMH, you have a great AMH, by the way, 6.8. The fact that your tubes are open, the fact that your partner's sperm count's really good, I would recommend exactly what they did, letrozole with IUI, because I think that'll give the sperm the best chance of kind of getting to where it needs to be.
I think, you know, when I think about cervical stenosis, I do kind of take the philosophy of if blood can come out, sperm can definitely get in. Mm-hmm. You know, they're quick, they're fast. The ones that, you know what they're doing are going to get the job done. And so, I mean, obviously you needed to have some dilation to help get the little catheter in. And so that's probably going to help the situation. And the thing is I always take not being able to get a catheter in for our listeners who are like, oh, I've had an HSG and my radiologist couldn't get the catheter in, but then I was able to get a saline ultrasound. A lot of that kind of has to do with the person who is potentially doing your HSG. Most HSGs are performed by people who were trained in radiology. Okay. So they are trained in imaging and they are really, really good at that. Versus we are really good at putting in speculums and things catheters. Up into your uterus.
And catheters.
And catheters. And so just because you may have had a difficult HSG or maybe that didn't, you know, it didn't happen the way that, you know, it didn't seem as smooth as it should be. Don't stress out that it's like, oh no, I have cervical stenosis. That sometimes it's more who was doing it, unfortunately.
Although I would say though, since she had a LEAP procedure, I mean, we do yes. see the people that have cervical stenosis and the ones that we have the hardest time getting catheters in are generally patients that have had surgery on their cervix. So mm-hmm. it sounds that all kind of fits, but Susan's right. I mean, plus the radiologists just don't have as many kind of things that we have up our sleeve to help like the
we've got more tools. We have more tools in our drawer than they do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
More tools, more tricks, and more experience on that particular thing. So yeah. Probably the biggest example that I can think of all this doesn't necessarily relate to the cervix, more relates to the tubes. But I've had people where their tubes have been completely and totally blocked on all the testing, and they managed to get pregnant because that itty-bitty teeny tiny little sperm manages to figure out a way through. So while that is not the norm, you know, those sperm have a way of getting places the rest of us don't have the benefit of that itty bitty size and that little powerhouse of a tail to send it swimming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Our next one. Hi, docs. I wish I could work with each of you. I adore your empathy, outlook, and all of the info you share with your listeners. Thank you so much. And thank you from us. That's very sweet.
Yeah, that's very sweet.
I'm 37. I've had blood work done 2 times recently, day 3 and day 4. She had an AMH 1.42 and 1.82, FSH 5.7 and 6.8, TSH 1.4 and 2.42, estradiol 60.9 and 85. My concern is that my E2 and thus FSH. I've heard the estradiol should be less than 70. And she also has a prior E2 at some point that was a day 3 that was 99. I believe if FSH is normal, but E2 is elevated, the elevated E2 could be artificially suppressing the FSH. You know what? This lady is absolutely brilliant. I have to give her kudos.
I'll keep reading the question.
Thoughts, could day 3 versus day 4 make a difference? Further info, I had one early miscarriage. Otherwise healthy. Can't thank you enough.
So to make sure that I'm getting the general gist of this, she's reasonably young. Mm-hmm. Her AMH
37.
She's 37.
Okay. I heard 27. So
37.
She's in that mid-range where we start to move quickly. And her AMH has been pretty okay, like 1.4 to 1.8, not anything definitively low. Mm-hmm. And her FSH has been good, but her estrogen has been a little bit on the higher side. Mm-hmm. And so she very rightly is making the connection between, hey, this is elevated. So if the estrogen's elevated, you can get a suppressed FSH, which makes your FSH look all hot and sexy. But in reality, it's not, because it's just squeezed into Spanx and hiding its true nature.
squeezed into Spanx.
I don't think I'm ever going to think about that the same way again.
I know, Carrie.
I just came up with that one on the fly because I'm like, oh yeah, that's totally what it's doing. It's a fake out. It is a complete and total fake out. Doesn't mean it's bad, and it's a very useful thing, but it's helpful to know. So I think she's absolutely right. I would agree. She's brilliant. She's figured it out. She has listened to us in what we have said, and us being the general classification of doctors. And so A+, madam, you have all of the gold stars in my book. And I don't think the day 3 versus day 4 makes a huge difference. You know, the reason we get it then is because we have a pretty good chance of seeing a low pair of numbers, both the FSH and the estradiol. And the reason we get both of those is because if one or the other is elevated, then that tempers how we think about
how valid the result is.
How valid the results are and how we apply them. And so I don't think I would really stress about day 3 versus 4. I would just take the information it's giving you of the system is not quite as tightly regulated and it's starting to grow those eggs before it really probably should have. And so take that information and do with it whatever makes the most sense based on what type of cycle you're doing. Like oftentimes suppression leading into the cycle will be really helpful because it will prevent that estrogen rising prematurely from a follicle. You'd rather give it an exogenous source or an outside source to suppress that. But there's a couple different ways you can deal with it. It's knowing that it's there to be dealt with that is the important thing in my mind.
So is this just on one cycle? Her estrogen level is 60 on day 3 and 85 on day 4?
She did it in separate months.
Okay.
A separate month.
Yeah, because sometimes you can have cysts on your ovaries that can bump the estrogen a little bit too. And I guess, mm-hmm. kind of looking at the big picture for me, nothing really changes whether your estrogen level is 60 or 50 or, I mean, your AMH is pretty good and you're 37 and kind of, we sort of know at 37, you need to get moving a little more quickly. And I think, I mean, overall, I think this is not a bad number for 37 at all. I mean, I wouldn't be too overly concerned, but just based on your age, we know, and you know, that you need to get moving a little bit quicker than somebody that's a little bit younger.
Yeah, I think it's a sign that time is important. And I mean, sometimes we even see this, I'll see it on ladies with PCOS who have like a mm-hmm. bajillion follicles. And
right.
it's not what you normally see in PCOS. Usually PCOS people are going to have that low estrogen. But I mean, I've had some of those, what I would consider, you know, extreme PCOS people who have like 60 follicles on both ovaries and
right.
you know, their estradiol comes back and it's like 100 and they're like stone cold baseline. I'm like, seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. It more helps us give us the validity, and it does tell us time is important, but I think you already know that. All right. So hello, I am a 32-year-old struggling with secondary infertility. My husband and I conceived our son who just turned 2 after 6 months of trying. We've been trying for a second child for over a year now. AMH is 1.6. Other hormone levels and thyroid levels are normal. Had an HSG, tubes are open. My husband has a normal semen analysis, 35 million total modal sperm. We are on our second round of IUI, currently in the 2-week wait. My question for you is there any other testing I should be exploring prior to moving to IVF? I'm feeling a little overwhelmed that may be our next step, given that we conceived our first child naturally. Thank you so much for our podcast. So additional mm-hmm. testing transitioning from IUI, which I'm sure there's quite a few of our listeners that are kind of in that situation.
Yeah.
Going into IVF, what new stuff do we want to do?
Well, I mean, we'll do infectious disease testing, but that's really kind of more for couples that we know are already going there and they're going to freeze embryos and that sort of thing. So infectious disease testing. She had an HSG. She didn't say how long ago that was, but she may want to consider a hysteroscopy to look more closely at her endometrium before she does an embryo transfer. Those are kind of really the big things. She's never had a miscarriage, so no reason to do a workup for that. I don't know. I can't think of anything else. What do you guys think?
So I would do a trial embryo transfer, and I usually do a saline ultrasound before going into IVF. I don't necessarily go straight into a hysteroscopy. We don't do office hysteroscopy where we are. So usually I'll do a saline ultrasound first. Perhaps doing some additional testing on the sperm. I know we don't necessarily all agree on DNA fragmentation, but I do tend to do DNA fragmentation going into IVF to see if that could potentially be an issue. Also, if you're kind of on the border, I think we have a recent episode on sperm QT. And sperm QT is a really neat test that what it does is it shows us if you there are genes that are within the sperm, okay? And the genes that sperm QT are specifically testing for are the ones that determine how well a sperm binds to, penetrates, and actually can fertilize the egg. And if these genes are dysregulated and they have these little methyl groups on them, then they don't have the same potential as other sperm. And so, you know, that can also be kind of something that may help you figure out, hey, maybe should I do another couple of IUI cycles or do I need to cut to the chase and go straight to IVF? Because IVF with ICSI essentially does the same thing that those genes are needing to do. So you bypass that problem.
So I have a question for you, Susan. Why would you do DNA fragmentation before IVF?
So I do, if somebody has DNA fragmentation, I use the Zymot device.
Oh, you do? Okay.
For sperm sorting. And I have had some good results. I've had some good results on, and I, you know, people are like, oh, it's the same thing as SwimUp. I don't necessarily think that because I've had people who have gone and done IVF cycles and did everything else exactly the same, except for adding the Zymot device, and they got pregnant. So for what it's worth, that's the reason why I do DNA fragmentation before going into IVF.
I mean, I think like these ladies have said, I would go for making sure that all the hysteroscopy or intrauterine evaluation of whatever sort has been done. I always want to make sure that a saline ultrasound's been done. We do in-office hysteroscopy, so we tend to default to that because it allows us to take a look more closely. Making sure that everything else is optimized. Like, we tend to do labs about once a year just to make sure that everything is copacetic. You're not diabetic, your thyroid is not suddenly misbehaving, you're not anemic, like any of the screwy stuff we want to know ahead of time. And often because people go through infertility treatment for a long time, if it's been a while since they had that basic set of labs, then we'll repeat those and make sure that everything is good. You know, optimizing all the stuff you can control, from weight to substances, you know, even nicotine patches and vaping, they've got an impact. So if we can make it as optimal as possible, let's do that. Those are the types of things that I look at before IVF.
Very good. All right. I just recently came across your podcast after searching for support groups for infertility. My husband and I are 23 years old, got off birth control, and soon after started trying to conceive. My husband had a birth defect when he was just 3 years old, causing him to have surgery to remove one of his testes that wouldn't descend. Fast forward a couple months and I have a gut feeling for him to have a semen analysis done. His first semen analysis looked awful. The concentration was 8, total sperm was 6, and the total modal was 0.36. Come to find out, the semen volume was only 0.8. We decided to do a second semen analysis a few weeks later, which turned out to be a little better. Concentration was 10, motility 28. Thoughts?
Hormonal workup for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I would check the lab levels. I would check perhaps some of the basic things. Like I might do a karyotype.
I would definitely do a karyotype.
That's kind of borderline on that. Tend to do mm-hmm. a hormone panel. You know, this for better or worse, you at least know, okay, this is some part of the issue and what we need to address. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of value in knowing that. I have a lot of couples, particularly the young ones, saying, well, what can we do? Can we do medication? Can we do herbal medicine? Can we do acupuncture? Can we stand on our head while dancing in the rain and playing hopscotch upside down? Like, people are willing to do absolutely everything. And you do have time because you are young, but no, all right, there's some known pathology here because he had that surgery. Who knows what the function of the other one is? At the very least, we know it's low. So even if you get the count up really high, I was kind of tucking in the back of my mind, what is going on with the sperm and is it as reliably functioning as we want it to be? With counts like this, you're in IVF territory, particularly with ICSI, where we can take the cutest, hottest, best swimmers winning the Olympic awards for swimming. We can pick those little guys and combine them directly with the egg, which at age 23 are probably going to be pretty gorgeous. And so, you know, I would kind of tuck that in the back of your mind and avoid some of the frustration and maybe just go, straight to what is most likely to work. But
well, and you know, and sometimes financially, when you're really young, you're just out of school, you have debt, or you don't have a lot of money. Many of us at 23 didn't have a lot of money, and
yeah, so I didn't have money for IVF at 23.
And so, but you know, it's kind of one of those things. I mean, the good news is you do have time on your side. I know you want to be pregnant now, but you know, even if you had to save money for a couple of years to do IVF for how many ever years, you're still going to be really young then. The one thing I would really recommend is to have your husband freeze sperm, because, you know, we just don't know if it's an ongoing process. We don't know if, you know, 6 months from now, his count's going to be zero. And so no one would want to look back at that point and go, gosh, if only we had frozen his sperm 6 months ago, he could be a father, and now he can't. So I would definitely find a fertility center, or I guess if you're not working with a fertility center, I'd find a fertility center where his sperm can be reliably frozen and stored. And that way, that takes a little bit of pressure off of everybody, because we know, you know, his total motile count, I think you said, was basically 360,000. Well, that's way more sperm that you probably would need for IVF. Literally, if you have 10 eggs, we need like 10 sperm from him that look beautiful or very handsome. And so he has probably plenty of sperm for that. But I would just recommend that he freeze maybe even a couple of specimens. His specimen count's so low that I would be afraid a little bit. If you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, you don't want to put all your sperm in one basket either. So I would have him come to the office a couple of times and freeze a couple of different specimens and just have those as insurance in case his sperm count doesn't improve down the road.
Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, the nice thing, and I know it's still frustrating being 23 and struggling to get pregnant. It doesn't make it any less real to you. And we totally get that. But
yeah,
you also have a little bit of time on your side. So I would recommend him have an evaluation with a urologist to do a physical exam, see if there's something structural that might be going on here. Mm-hmm. You know, doing basic hormonal labs on him, checking his FSH, his testosterone, prolactin, mm-hmm. TSH, those types of things. See if there's something. I mean, he may be a candidate for Clomid therapy. And mm-hmm. and there are times in our practices, you know, if you come in and you're 37 or 42 and we've got, you know, 360,000 sperm, we're like, you know, time isn't necessarily our friend. You have 3 or 6 months that you could spend doing some of these lesser invasive options and see if he's one of the people who does respond. You know, because a lot of times people go straight to IVF because they're like, well, we could do something for 3 months and we may not get a response, which is completely true, is completely accurate. But in the grand scheme of biological time and having to lay out, you know, $20,000 IVF, you know, for you, 3 months might be worthwhile to take that pathway to see if other options open up available to you. I mean, you're probably not going to get to a range where you don't need any help, but if you could get to a range where you need less help, it might be at least financially advantageous.
And for the love of all that is holy, don't let him take testosterone.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Anything that will totally wipe out his sperm production. A lot of people think, oh, my testosterone's low, I need to take more to increase it. And while taking the medication will increase your levels, it will turn off your sperm production. So don't do it.
And it can sometimes turn off your sperm production permanently. We've all seen people come in and it's like, oh, well, I've been taking, you know, it's more likely to happen if you're on it long-term, you know, our 5-10 year users. But, you know, testosterone getting doled out like candy is very, very common nowadays.
Yes, it is.
And I know it makes the guys feel good, but it doesn't necessarily make the swimmers good, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right. We want to do one or two more questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Hi, Fertility Docs. I have a question about testing. Should I advocate and ask for a 3D ultrasound to determine whether my uterus is bicornuate or septate? I am 34 years old and recently experienced a miscarriage due to a blighted ovum. I'm scheduled for a DNC. My OB wants to do an HSG after I'm healed, but from the research I've done, that a 3D ultrasound would be a better route to really determine what is the shape of my uterus. My husband and I want to set ourselves up to the best chance of success we can. He's 37 and we both are so ready and excited to be a mom and dad. Hoping to get your expert advice, and thank you for the awesome podcast.
That's a really good question. You know, In the right hands, a 3D ultrasound would be really helpful, but I will tell you, there's not a lot of people that can do GYN ultrasound really, really well. So if you're at a fertility center, I think that would be a reasonable option. Personally, I really like to send patients for MRIs because I feel like I get a better kind of real read on what's going on. I can talk it over to the radiologist, kind of figure out how far the septum goes down and if it goes down very far. And, you know, honestly, having operated on several people with both bicornuate and septate uteruses, sometimes it's not as easy as you might think. It's not real cut and dried. There's been at least a couple of situations where even I'm kind of going, well, I'm not sure which it is. But the nice thing about an MRI is you can really kind of delineate where the septum starts and where the muscle starts. And that gives us some sense for, is this a bicornuate or is this septate uterus? And in our minds, is this something we can fix or something we don't need to fix? And to that end, and this is one step further, there was a recent study that came out. It was a randomized prospective study that looked at treatments of septate uteruses and whether or not it was beneficial. And this randomized prospective study showed that in two different groups of people, and it was an international group, the United States, Germany, a couple other countries in Europe, and basically showed that there was really no difference in outcomes in terms of pregnancies, full-term pregnancies, whether the septum was removed or not. So, you know, if you didn't mention if you've had a pregnancy before or not, but I'm guessing you probably haven't, but I would be a little hesitant about just jumping right in and having surgery done if, you know, maybe you don't really need it.
Well, and it depends on what the septum is like. Like a really mild septum doesn't necessarily need to be operated on. One that totally divides the cavity in half, that one needs to be operated on. It kind of depends. I'm like Abby. I tend to appreciate MRIs because particularly when you have an abnormality of the Müllerian system, which is kind of the originating system of where the uterus comes from, it's not just the uterus. You worry about the kidneys, the spinal structure, skeletal structure, all of that. So it's nice to know, particularly if you're talking about any kind of surgery, how everything is laid out in there. Because if you have a duplicated renal tract, so instead of having, you know, one ureter that connects your bladder and your kidney, you've got two sets. It's always nice to know what you're going into because it just helps give you more information, helps your surgeon do the planning, and you know a little bit more with what you're dealing with.
So this is one of those times that we're going to agree to disagree. And I totally agree that the textbook says that, and it's great that it's y'all's experience. I am not a big fan of MRI. Throughout my practice, whether I was in residency fellowship in Minnesota, Texas, wherever I am, I find that radiology reports are exceedingly hesitant to like really call something.
Oh yeah, you gotta call them.
I've gone in and done surgery on so many of those people that like nothing added up. And like, you finally got an answer. And so I would say in the hands of a skilled reproductive endocrinologist, not a general radiologist, but in the hands of a skilled reproductive endocrinologist, between an ultrasound and a saline ultrasound, you're going to have a pretty darn good idea if you have a septum versus a bicornuate uterus. Okay. Uh-huh. And I am a very minimalist when it comes to surgery, but that's the like one group of people that if it's really seems to be a huge issue, you know, considering doing a laparoscopy to see truly what the top of the uterus looks like. Back to the patient's question, 3D ultrasound, I don't necessarily think is absolutely necessary. I think a 2D ultrasound in good hands is going to get you what you need most likely, but it's making sure it's in good hands. And also, you know, and to Carrie's point about, you know, if you do have, you know, a bicornuate uterus, we do absolutely need to know what the renal structure is, but then you actually have to have an MRI of the full abdomen and pelvis. And so what I often do is if I find out it is a bicornuate uterus, then I'll have them do a renal ultrasound, which is less expensive. So it's another option. It's just another way of doing it.
So the point about MRI, I agree 100%, Susan. Every MRI report that I get says septate versus bicornuate. So what I do is I pick up the phone, I get the radiologist on the phone and I go, tell me what you're seeing. So is there a septum down the middle? Where do you see the muscle stop? And so that's what is really helpful. And so, but yeah, I don't just read the report. That's one of the ones where you have to call a radiologist and you have to talk to him.
Yeah, it's so good stuff. All right, let's do one more. I just turned 34. My husband and I got pregnant with our first baby after 1 month of trying about 6 years ago. They have a healthy five-year-old, again, got pregnant and had another child. No issues conceiving. Now we're trying for our third. We had a chemical pregnancy in August of 22, another chemical pregnancy in November of 22, and then another in January of 23. Had labs done. Thyroid was a bit lower than for someone trying to get pregnant. I was put on levothyroxine and thyroid labs came back normal. OB is sending us to an RE. What should be our next step? Is there any hope for us? What should our RE be looking for?
I'm sorry, Susan, did she say age in there that I missed?
She's 34.
34, yeah.
Okay.
So three miscarriages after two successful pregnancies and has had thyroid labs done, started on, it sounds like, some Synthroid that normalize those thyroid labs. So if we want to talk about the thyroid labs a little bit and then maybe a little bit about recurrent pregnancy loss workup.
Yeah. So with respect to the other labs, the thyroid's a key part of it. It is not the be-all, end-all. Everybody loves to blame everything in the free world on the thyroid, which oftentimes it deserves. I mean, it is truly a troublemaker, but sometimes it's a troublemaker that's just like thumbing their nose in the back of the class and not actually doing anything wrong. So worth paying attention to, worth treating, but oftentimes not the full story. I would get, once you are well clear of any pregnancy hormones, the HCG levels have been down to zero for, I would say, at least 6 weeks, then there's a set of recurrent pregnancy loss labs that I would get, looking at clotting factors. You know, I tend to order karyotypes as well, which is checking to see whether or not you have 46 chromosomes that are arranged the way they should be. And while having had two healthy kids is a really good sign, there's not any genetic issues.
Not a guarantee.
There's no guarantee.
You much rather check on it and know, because knowing that answer will give you a much clearer path of, okay, this is what we think needs to happen next. So I would definitely get all the RPL labs. I would check the inside of the uterus with a saline sonogram, hysteroscopy, potentially both, depending on what's found, and really start to look into that more, because there's more than just the thyroid that's causing, can cause problems with that.
Yeah, and you may just want to check a progesterone level. You know, we worry a little bit if it's a biochemical pregnancy that maybe your body's not kicking out progesterone the way it should. So you may want to check a progesterone level. You know, like Carrie has said before, it's like dumping water in the ocean if you had progesterone. So I'm always a big fan of doing that. It's easy, it's cheap. And so I would think about doing that as well. You may want to consider lupus anticoagulant, anticardiolipin antibodies. Mm-hmm. Those are antibodies that basically may interfere with the blood flow between you and the baby. Again, it's unlikely you've had two children, healthy children. It's unlikely that that's an issue, but some of those things can be acquired. So those are the things I would think about.
So make sure your prolactin level is normal. Prolactin is a little hormone created by your brain that normally makes you get breast milk after you have babies. But if you potentially have had a little growth on your pituitary, that could make things a little off and affect your risk of miscarriage. You're 34, which is not old, but it is older. Okay. It's older than you were when you conceived your first two. And so I would still recommend, you know, getting ovarian reserve labs. Sometimes we can see miscarriage being a reflection of that, you know, things aren't going quite as well with your ovaries as what we'd expect, as well as getting your tubes checked out. You know, you didn't give us any history about if you had any infections associated with your, deliveries or anything like that, like chorioamnionitis. And just because you had two doesn't mean that there is not a tubal factor, that you might have something like swollen fallopian tubes, hydrosalpinx, that could be increasing that risk of pregnancy loss.
All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground. To our audience, thanks for listening and tune in next week for more. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review in Apple Podcasts. We'd really love to hear from you. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Be sure to follow us and subscribe to stay updated on all things infertility.
You can also visit fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions you have about infertility. All questions will be answered anonymously on our Ask the Doc segment or our question episodes. And brand new, listen up, hot breaking news. We are planning a conference in New Braunfels, which is Texas, between San Antonio and Austin, pretty close to both cities. It's going to be October 28th, 2023. So mark your calendars, come out and hang out with us for a day. It's going to be everything that we do in the podcast, but actually in person. more succinct, more tailored to exactly what people want to know when they want to know it. So
mark and your calendar. And lots of interaction.
And lots of interaction. Yeah, you will be so tired of us by the end of the day. So mark your calendars and plan to come spend a day with us.
All right. As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye.